Okay, today's the last class of the semester, and at least according to the schedule, it's supposed to be the last one of Avram Shapiro, but it probably will not be. I think there's more. We need more time with him. I do, however, want, if we have time now, to respond to the final comments of you. A number of people have emailed me. The final comments I got, let me begin with something relating to the topic we've dealt with a number of times this semester, day schools. One of you asked me about Manhattan Talmudical Academy, Yeshivas Rabbi Tzalchan Az High School, and I looked in Gurak's volume here, Orthodox Jews in America, and he dates it to 1916, but that's a high school, not an elementary school. But he also, on page 111, discusses a school that later, Eitz Chaim, which is really the beginning of Yeshivas, Rabbi Yitzchak, and then becomes, obviously, YU, how it begins as a sort of a, he calls it a day school, and there was a law in New York from 1874 that everyone should instruct their children in basic secular subjects, but if you read here, you see that there is very little in the way of secular education. Similarly, the school called Beit Sefer Tiferes Yerushalayim, which later became known as Rabbi Jacob Joseph, begins in 1901, and this is also an elementary school. But Gurak describes how here, too, there's hardly any secular subjects. So I don't know if we want to refer to these as day schools, and basically they're just traditional yeshivas giving them an hour of secular subjects. But those who are interested can see it in Gurak. I'll be reviewing this book in a new journal. There's a new journal that's going to be coming out, sort of like a New York Review of Books, that's going to deal with Jewish subjects, issues of Jewish thought. So I'm going to be reviewing this book in that. Next, one of you wanted to know, coming into the summer, the fast days, me to elaborate a bit on what I told you about Reb Chaim, the view of the fast days. Now, I wrote about this a bit, and it's quite fascinating. Reb Schechter, in his book Nefesh HaRav, quotes Reb Chaim Soloveitchik as saying that today no one is obligated in any fasts except for Yom Kippur. Because according to Halacha, if you have the status of a sick person who's not shein bo sakana, that is, you're sick but you're not deathly ill, but still, if you're sick, you're not obligated in any of the fast days except for Yom Kippur. And in fact, Reb Chaim didn't even believe in he rejected the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that in Yom Kippur, if you have to eat, you have to eat pachos mikashir. You eat a little bit over a little bit of time. And Reb Chaim said, no, you eat like a normal person. Now, this is pretty amazing to say that technically you're not obligated in any of the fast days. And I asked Reb Schechter about this. And he actually put me in touch with someone who put me in touch with someone. Name is Aaron Schreiber. According to Aaron Schreiber, he heard this, and apparently this is a famous story from the students of Rav Simcha Sheps. Rav Sheps is a Rosh Hashiva at Torah Vadasi. He was a Rosh Hashiva. Rav Sheps came in. He studied with the Brisker Rav in Israel. He came into the Brisker Rav one day on Tisha B'Av, and lo and behold, the Brisker Rav and his family are sitting around the table eating. If you take this story to be true, and it's hard to imagine that Rav Sheps is lying, this was Halacha L'maisa, and I wanted to confirm this today, so I spoke to Rabbi Schreiber's son, who is S. Daniel, or B. Daniel Schreiber. You might have seen the volumes Nora Os Harav. There's about 16 booklets. They're more than booklets. Some are about 100 pages or so. Torah of the Rav. And I just spoke to him a little while ago. I was calling his father, actually, and no one was answering, so I called him. Turns out his father just had a stroke, unfortunately. You might know him if you're from Queens or Lawrence, where the son lives. But the son told me that this is well known among all the students, that and that's the story, that it was on Tisha B'Av that Rav Sheps came in. Now, this is interesting. Professor Tursky, my teacher, said, when he was told about one of these things from Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim had all sorts of these things. If you look at Nefesh HaRav, there's other descriptions of Reb Chaim. Professor Tursky said Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was, quote, a hypochondriac. About the thing I told you before about not eating pachos kashir and allowing people pretty easily to eat on Yom Kippur if he thought that they were ill, Reb Chaim said, I'm not mekil, I'm not lenient on Yom Kippur, I'm machmir on dinei nefashos, I'm stringent on dinei nefashos. And Reb Chaim and the Briskers always had this great fear of death and sickness, and so why are we considered cholim today? Because the generations have declined, I guess. We're weak. Now, I wrote in my article that had Reb Chaim ever publicized this and made this into a halacha, it would cause a split in Jewry, and he wasn't a revolutionary. And that's why Rav Zevin says that Rav Chaim had all sorts of strange new ideas. He didn't publicize them because he didn't want to break with tradition. And therefore, although among his students you have all sorts of interesting practices that go against the Shulchan Aruch, we've already spoken about one, not wearing tzitzis on Shabbos, he never publicized them because he didn't want to break with the tradition. I even wrote on the Sfarim blog why I think it's very wrong that in the Rav's Machzor they include all the practices right at the time when you're supposed to be davening, because the Rav never wanted this. And in his own shul in Boston, they didn't change the minhagim. But that's the business of to be a cholah. I mean, no one else accepted it, just Reb Chaim, and I thought it was only theoretical until Rav Schechter put me on to speak to this person, and apparently it's well known in Tarav Hadass, this story. Why is this interesting? In addition to because it's just interesting, because a new sefer just came out. Shelos Achuvos from Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, and we will deal with him in a future class. And he's the Leif HaIvri, a proto-Zionist of a sort, a very unusual person. In Volume 1, Number 174, he quotes the Chosam Sofer as being extremely lenient for all sorts of women on fasting, telling them that basically other than Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, they shouldn't fast unless they're in very good health, and certainly not pregnant or nursing women. And the same psak, by the way, of nursing women is given in this sefer we've spoken about, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Siach Nachum. But he goes even further. He quotes the Chosam Sofer as saying that if I was strong enough, if I had the strength, regarding the Tanios, the four Tanios, except for Tisha B'Av, except for Yom Kippur, it's not clear. He says the four Tanios, except for Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, that would be the three Tanios. He says, though, that at least the three, certainly, I would get rid of them for many people, and certainly for the women. Why? And he gives the same reason. Now we're weak. I don't know. I find this all quite strange because I don't consider myself weak, and except for when I was in Germany and Tisha B'Av ended like 10:30 at night, I don't see how we are weaker. So I don't know what to make of this. But if any of you are close to the Briskers, you can look into this. Okay, one more thing I want to call your attention to. I mentioned this book last week. For those who are lovers of Rav Uziel Uvnei Zmano, if you can't see, you can enlarge the picture. Edited by Tzvi Zohar. All sorts of articles about Rav Uziel and other Sephardic rabbis of the 20th century, but nothing about the Moroccans here. So that was good. And finally, a new book came out from Rav Avadia Yosef's son, Ein Yitzchak. Three volumes, if you can believe it. He apparently will be the next chief rabbi of Jerusalem. The amount of learning in this book and the other books is really unbelievable, incomprehensible. He's his father's son. Rav Yitzchak Yosef, not Rav David Yosef, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the author of the Yalkut Yosef. And in volume one, page, it's all about calling. Kali, the rules of Psak, rules of the Shulchan Aruch, all sorts of stuff. Yes, and as for the Bracha on Bamba, it's an argument between him. He holds that it's Shahako, or maybe I'm confused, and his brother of David Yosef, who's written the many volumes of Halacha Brura, who's the Rav of Har Nof, holds it's Mizonot, or Hadama, sorry, the other way around, maybe Hadama. One Shahako, one says Hadama, and the father of Havadia holds like both of them. He's given his approval to both sons, so how is that possible? I don't know, but he's given his haskama. Apparently, each one has his haskama. But they apparently asked him about it, and he said that lechatchila you can follow, you should follow Rav Yitzchak Yosef, but b'diavad you follow Rav David Yosef, whatever that's supposed to mean. I think he loves both his sons, so he's convinced by each one. But on page 83, he quotes something from a student of the Chavetz Chaim who claims to have heard it from the Chavetz Chaim's own mouth. If you recall, when we did Rav Nissim, I quoted the letter of the Chavetz Chaim to Rav Nissim, in which he replied to Rav Nissim, asked him, what about doing a Mishnah Berurah and Yerodeya? And he said he was too busy with his commentary on Toras Kohanim. But here he's quoted as the Chavetz Chaim is quoted as expressing regret about the Mishnah Berurah. He saw that the Mishnah Berurah became so popular, people stopped looking at the sources of Halacha, the Sugyot HaShas, with the Rishonim, and he was very upset about this, and therefore he didn't want to put out another Mishnah Berurah. So that's quite interesting, an idea that an author is upset with what became of his book. I think you could say the same thing about the Rambam. The Rambam's book was supposed to be the final word in Psak, and instead it created thousands of commentaries and other discussions, but that's interesting. Okay, let us now then go on to deal with Rav Avraham Shapiro, the great Rav Avraham Shapiro. Here he is again. I ended last class talking about... let's see. You know, it's funny you'd say that. I've heard that before also. I think he must be exaggerating when he says he never heard of it. Because his youth was the 50s. It still was... It had been reprinted, it was quoted. Now, it wasn't the way it is today. I mean, in the 50s, the Chavetz Chaim had died in 1933. There was no one regarded it as a canonical book. It was a book just like the Aruch HaShulchan and other books, and so it's got to be a figure of speech. But it's true, it wasn't studied the way it is now. The Aruch HaShulchan was favored by many. I think in your youth, Simcha, and maybe Rav Shechter's youth, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and the Chai Adam were more popular than the Mishnah Berurah. But now it's obviously of great popularity. Rav Avraham Shapiro had a great dispute, a machokas, when he took over Merkaz Harav. As we mentioned last class, he was from the traditional Rosh Yeshiva model. Rosh Yeshiva, expert in Shas, great in Psak as well. He had been a Dayan for many years. We already saw, however, that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook was more of a Hasidic Rebbe, a Musar figure. Now, there was a great student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. There is a great student. His name is Rav Tzvi Tau. And he was the heir in Hashkafa. He was really the duplicate, almost, or the Talmud Muvhak in philosophy. And they don't call it philosophy or Hashkafa, they call it Emunah. Just like Rav Tzvi Yehuda is the Hemshech Absoluti, the absolute continuation of his father, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook was the follower of, Rav Tzvi Tau was a follower of Tzvi Yehuda Cook. He comes from Austria. He is not regarded as an expert in Shas and Poskim, but he is an expert in the writings of Cook and very close to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And if you look at Rav Tzvi Tau's books, they read just like Rav Cook's books. They're along the same sort of writing, and the same as Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And who is Rav Avraham Shapiro? He's not from the Cooks. He married into the family. He comes from the Chevron Yeshiva. He's a posek. But he's not part of the Hashkafa. He's not in the Cook ideology. So there was a great dispute. Should he take over? Well, there were two schools in Merkaz. There was the school of Rav Avraham. Rav Avraham had been there now for many, many years, decades. And he had many students. And then there was Rav Tau, who also had many students. Now, Rav Avraham was never a Messianic Zionist. Rav Tau was a Messianic Zionist. When I say a Messianic Zionist, I mean following Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, seeing settling the land and the state of Israel as part of the whole Messianic process, and not just as a slogan, like we say Shabbos in davening, but actually part of the Messianic process. Rav Tzvi Yehuda thought that the state is holy, that the army's holy. It's a very different approach. Rav Avraham was never one to regard the state as holy, the army as holy, was never one to regard, you know, the state is valuable, and it's the path on the way to the Messianic era, certainly, but it's not actually part of the Messianic era in the same way that Rav Tzvi Yehuda wrote about, and we'll get into this in more detail soon. but let me just say now, you can see the dispute very clearly between them in how they looked upon the withdrawal from Gaza. The followers of Rav Tau, and especially Rav Aviner, refused to oppose the soldiers in any sort of civil disobedience. They argued that the soldiers are carrying out the commands of the Malchus Hashem, you know, the state of Israel, even if in this case the kingdom is making a terrible mistake, but the soldiers are doing their duty, we must not disobey them, and if you're a soldier, you must follow the orders. They didn't even use language like others would use, that if you don't, it's sedition. They simply said these are orders from the government, which has the status of Malchus, of the kingship, and even if it's wrong, you must follow them. And these are not, it's not like the violation of Shabbos or Kashrus or anything. These are not individual decisions. These are governmental decisions. So if the government makes a mistake, it's not for an individual to oppose it. The army is holy, even if it's making a mistake. In fact, Rav Aviner led groups of people who actually hugged and kissed the soldiers to show that they loved them. And even though they disagreed with them, they still showed them great respect. They understood that they were part of a holy army. Let me just read you something. This year, Pesach, I get the Merkaz newsletter. And they're still having recollections of Rav Avram Shapiro. And there's a group of Balabatim there from America, especially, who had a shiur with him. I think it was once a week. And one of the Balabatim, I'll mention his name. Some of you might know him. Some of you listening now from Israel or others. His name is Dr. Aryeh Hirsch. And he has an article about his shiur with Rav Avram. And he talks about how after one of the shiurim, he went back to Rav Avram's apartment because he had to ask him a question. Something was bothering him terribly. And let me just read you the paragraph. Shortly after the disengagement, I went back to Rav Avram's apartment, shaken to my roots. I had been in Gush Katif during the disengagement and had seen evictees hugging and kissing soldiers. And I had to ask, there are no two ways about this. Either I am normal, and I'm appalled by the huggers, or they are normal, and my whole way of thinking about ethics is wrong. Which is it? And the answer was, you're the normal one. I mean, for Rav Avram Shapiro, as we'll see, the idea that you're going to hug this army which is doing such a terrible thing, you're going to... Absolutely not, as we'll see. I mean, Rav Tau wrote a letter to Moshe Katsav when the allegations were first raised about him, writing a letter telling him he should be strong, he should ignore these allegations. It's just like Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Gemara, is also accused of improper behavior. I asked one of the people who knows this community very well, how could Rav Tau write this without even investigating the facts? And at the time, it appeared that the facts were that Katsav was guilty. And he answered me that it's not Katsav. It's the office of the presidency. The office represents Malchus, it represents the people of Israel, and that therefore it needs to be respected. And if Katsav has sinned, okay, we'll find a way, he'll have to resign or something, but he cannot be publicly attacked. I think from most of our standpoints, these sorts of things can't be done privately, they have to be done publicly. It's the only way you can get to where you need to go. In a democracy, these things need to be raised, but no, the office of the presidency must be respected. When the Machteret, the underground, was discovered, Rav Tau was outraged. Now, why was Rav Tau outraged? I'm not going to say he's certainly very right-wing. He's not a lover of, the Palestinians. And he's a great believer, obviously, in settlements everywhere you can. He's outraged because this was rebellion against the government. We can oppose the government, but we cannot rebel against the government. And in this, he's following Rav Tzihuda. Rav Tzihuda said about Yamit, when he saw the people were not with them, you have to abandon it. He ordered Rav Moshe Bleicher, who's the Rosh Hashiva in Chevron, not to allow Moshe Levinger to give shiurim in the yeshiva. He refused, and as far as I know, to this day, refuses to have anything to do with Moshe Levinger. What was Levinger's crime? It wasn't planting the bombs. I'm sure the Rav Tau thought that under normal circumstances this might be a fine way to show the Arabs a thing or two. No. He was a Mori B'Malchus. He undermined the government. He broke the law. he showed complete disregard for the state as Malchus, as a holy government. Not each individual government per se is holy, but the idea of government is holy, and we can do nothing to undermine it. And Moshe Revinger, by taking the law into his own hands, undermined the government. He also opposed strong criticism of Tal, of the Prime Minister, since while you can disagree with a position of his, he is the embodiment of the people of Israel and must be respected no matter who it is. This is the ideology known as Malchiut, that Mamachtiut. That is, your love for the land and the state is such that you give even the positions of authority, the governmental structure, holiness. And there was a great dispute about this during the Gaza withdrawal. Rav Avram, however, was never one to focus on political issues of settling the land or of issues of machshava. When he came into power at the yeshiva, as we mentioned, came into line with the other yeshivas, with the stress on traditional learning. The only time he broke with this, as far as I know, is with the withdrawal from Gaza and later from the West Bank, when Rav Avram began to involve himself politically and was the major force. They began the withdrawals after the withdrawal from Gaza. They started talking about, and they actually did have certain withdrawals from the West Bank. Well, when Sinai was given, he wasn't going to say anything because he was a teacher at Merkaz. That was early 1980s, and Ritzi Yehuda was the Rosh Yeshiva. Ritzi Yehuda, who was very opposed to withdrawal, once he saw that it could not be stopped, and that the people, especially the people, were in favor of it, he said, we cannot not protest. This is what the people want. The government is really representing them. If the government did not represent the people, that would be a different situation, I think, for Rav Tal also. But as long as the government has the support of the people, and in Yamid it clearly did. With Gaza, I think it also did, although the percentages were much closer. We do not protest. Now, Sinai is different, as we'll see, because Sinai will have different halachic implications, perhaps. Rav Goren was the first one, really, to give a psak, and then other people followed him towards the end of his life, that no settlement could be evacuated. But when he gave that psak, it wasn't really so much halacha l'maisa. It wasn't practical, because they really weren't evacuating anything at that time. And he didn't really have the standing towards the end of his life. He was no longer chief rabbi. He didn't really have a following, unlike Rav Avraham. And for Rav Avraham, this was not a political issue. This was a halachic issue, pure and simple. He never saw Kedusha in the state, per se. The state is valuable if it follows halacha, if it does proper things. Then we will see it as the beginning of the redemption. If it doesn't, then it doesn't. Rav Tal, from Rav Tal's perspective, and the people who follow him, they have this vision of the beginning of the redemption, more than the beginning. Ritzi Yehuda thought we were already in the Messianic process, and nothing can change that. So you can point to Oslo and withdrawal from Gaza. They will just see this as stumbles along the way. So we're going in this, and we've stumbled, but then we move up. Nothing, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, a self-fulfilling ideology, because nothing the state can do will change their views of it. I guess maybe if they started putting people in concentration camps or things like that, it would change their view of the state, but short of that, nothing will change it. That's not the case with many others. There was a Rosh Yeshiva in Gaza named Shmuel Tal, a follower of Avram Shapiro. He, after the expulsion, he began to say, well, we have to move closer to the Haredim, that this is not the state that we hoped for, and we were wrong in regarding it as a Schatz Gula. Rav Avram didn't go that far, but for him, it was conditional on how the state acts. We'll get back to this in a few minutes, but let me talk a little bit more about Rav Tal. Why wasn't Rav Tal appointed Rosh Yeshiva? If Rav Tal is really much more of the ideological successor from Ritzi Yehuda, why wasn't he appointed? His students wanted to know that. Now, his students really are, though, the most extreme in the religious Zionist world. They actually opened up a cheder in Jerusalem for their children. This is when Rav Tal was still at Merkaz. The women, not only don't they wear shadels, that's obvious, they don't wear makeup. They're very simple. They have many characteristics of a sect. And they focus on the study of Emunah in the path of Ritzi Yehuda. It's a very different conception of a yeshiva with Emunah being central to it, not Talmud study. Now, however, Rav Avraham had already been made Rosh Yeshiva in Rav Tzvi Yehuda's lifetime. He had been made the second most important figure. Rav Tzvi Yehuda wanted to bring the yeshiva back into the mainstream, apparently. So it was only natural that leadership fell to him. And the other Ramin, the other teachers at the yeshiva, were almost exclusively, not all, but almost all, students of him, because he had appointed them. So obviously he had their support. Now, this dispute had been going on since Rav Tzvi Yehuda died, and I became aware of it for the first time when I was at Merkaz for Shabbos. I stayed at the house of someone, he was a big student of Rav Tao, stayed at his apartment, and this was in 92, so it's about 10 years after Rav Tzvi Yehuda died, and that was the first time I was aware of any disputes going on. Rav Shaul Yisraeli was still alive, so maybe he was 91, I forget what year Rav Shaul Yisraeli died, and my host, Zev Neumann is his name, if any of you know him, he edits a lot of Rav Shalat's books and others, he told me that Rav Avram didn't share their ideology, and I didn't know what he meant by that, and he explained, you know, he didn't see the state as inherently holy, that sort of thing, and it was on that Shabbos that I first met Rav Tao. Friday night, we went, there was a sicha with Rav Avraham and Rav Yisraeli, but the next day I met Rav Tao, and it was explained to me that Rav Avraham didn't have this same messianic type of conception of where history's going. He was more traditional, I guess you could say. But it was completely hidden, underground, other than in Merkaz. There nothing appeared about it in the newspapers. I used to read these stuff. I didn't hear anything about this. At that time, when I met Rav Tao in the early 90s, he was still at the yeshiva, and he was allowed to teach students Emunah. Teach them, the philosophy of Rav Kook. But not in the yeshiva. He was welcome in the yeshiva, and he davened there, that's when I met him after shul. But he was only permitted to teach in his house. Which you could say is a bit of an insult, but if you recall the Nazir taught in his house, he never taught at the yeshiva. Because there was a dispute in the yeshiva of Avraham, the compromise was that he would teach in his house, not in the yeshiva. Everything came to a head when in 1996, Rav Avraham agreed to open up a teacher's institute at Merkaz, where they would teach non-objectionable things, pedagogy and the like. You know, how can that be objectionable? Rav Tao and his students protested vehemently, and when you understand their reason for opposition, in a sense, they're not just Haredim, they're even close to the Eda Haredit, in a sense. What was the problem? What could possibly be the problem about an institute for education, to teach people to be good teachers, things like that? Well, you're bringing in, I don't know, Piaget, you're bringing in all sorts of non-Jewish ideas. And that's impossible. You can't have that in a yeshiva. So you're going to say, we live our life with non-Jewish ideas. Non-Jews invented the car, the airplane, but that's not in a yeshiva. A yeshiva is completely holy. You cannot have any connection to yeshiva that has anything not Jewish. Now, I don't know. What's not Jewish about teaching people how to, it's a hechsher mitzvah. What's not Jewish about the good methods of education? But that's what Rav Tao said. If Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have it, or Rabbi Akiva didn't have it, then it's not Jewish. You know, David, you could be right, but that's not how it's described in the standard works I've seen, and not how it's described in this book, Hadatiyim Chadashim by Yair Shelag. And not only that, there's an article by, I forget who wrote it, it's in the Yoska Achituv Jubilee volume, if I recall correctly, about the split. And the whole issue was the Teachers Institute, according to that article. But if you can get other information about it, please let me know. Now, you might know, David, others might know, Rav Tao since then has become well known for his attacks on Har Etzion, Yeshivas Har Etzion, because they have this Machon Herzog, the Teachers Institute there, which has all sorts of Tanakh conferences and all sorts of interesting things going on, which he regards as non-traditional. But his students, there were even, in this article I mentioned, he quotes from the booklets they wrote. They saw this as a reenactment of the Netziv's battle to keep the Volozhin Yeshiva pure. Although now we know that this itself is a legend, it's a myth. And that's not the reason the Volozhin Yeshiva was closed. It really was closed because they already had secular studies. The government thought it was becoming a place for nihilists and things like that. What happened, though, with this rebellion, this revolt, was that some of the Ramim, some of the teachers in the yeshiva, took Rav Tao's side. And you can't have the yeshiva where there's rebellion, where there's sedition in the yeshiva, where some of the Ramim do not accept the authority of the Rosh Yeshiva. You can read in this book and in the article I mentioned what Rav Avram did. He tried to get them to stop. He tried to suspend them. Finally, and obviously he was very let down. Rav Avram gave an interview in which he explained how hurt he was that his own students rebelled against him and stood up to him. Well, Ponovej doesn't really have a Rosh Yeshiva. That's the thing about Ponovej. They have, two Rosh Yeshiva. You're right, they've been fighting, but apparently there's almost, two yeshivas there now. So you're right. I guess it's an exaggeration to say you can't have it in the yeshiva, but you can't have it in the yeshiva if you have a dominant figure in the yeshiva. Ponovej has no dominant figure. You have two people fighting over it. The classic story of yeshivas, when they fight over it, is they split. Chevron split. Itri, become, you all remember, split tree. That's what yeshivas do. They split. I have a Sfarim blog post that's going to be coming up pretty soon. They're redoing the Sfarim blog. It's actually, they're withdrawing from the RCA. I can't exactly give you the details as to why, but Yesh Devarim Bego, put it that way. So I'm putting up a post, and I'm quoting from a rabbi in Scranton, and he wasn't Scranton, the turn of the century, his name is Eskolsky, who asks a very interesting question. Why is it, or he was asked this interesting question, why is it that you have someone who has a store, and someone else with a similar store opens in town, and they can get along fine, you know, they're obviously competitors, but they can get along, but when you have rabbis, you have one rabbi, another rabbi moves in, you see hatred of rabbis is like no other hatred. And he explains what it is, why rabbis hate each other so much. I know it's very off-putting. Balei Tshuva come into the fold, and they can't believe it when they see rabbis who hate each other this way, and, that's life. So he has a whole Torah explanation as to why, out of all professions, rabbis hate each other more than others hate each other, and I'm going to write a little bit about that, but in yeshivas you have the same thing. You have Rosh Yeshiva, not just rabbis, Rosh Yeshiva who hate other Rosh Yeshiva, and there's been terrible controversies. The Tzar Vadas controversy, you had two great Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Gedalia Shor, and they wouldn't talk to each other. And you've had other cases like this, and it's all very sad. You've had in all sorts of yeshivas, you had situations like that. But here, Rav Avram was the Rosh Yeshiva with almost unanimous support, or 75-80% support of the Ramim. So you had troublemakers of other Ramim, and you had students who opposed him. What does he do? He fires Rav Tao. What else can you do? And he suspended the other teachers. When I say fired him, I think technically it might have actually been a suspension, that you're suspended until you fall into line. But that's really a firing, because he had no interest in falling into line. So they established their own yeshiva. Apparently now it's a very large yeshiva. I say apparently because I've never been there, but I hear it has hundreds of students. Yeshivat Har Hamor. Har Hamor stands for Membav Resh, Hey Membav Resh, or Hey Mem Resh, actually they spell it. Hemshech Merkaz Harav. They see themselves as the true Merkaz Harav, the authentic Merkaz Harav. Unfortunately, Merkaz Harav still is called Merkaz Harav, so they can't use that name, Merkaz Harav, but they are the true Yeshivas Merkaz Harav. And I have to say that they really are the followers of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the ideological followers, much more than Rav Avram Shapiro. Rav Tzvi Yehuda's message and ideas are still central at Merkaz. But Rav Avraham is not ideologically a follower of Tzvi Yehuda. And many people in Merkaz can accept that. They say that for Machshava we have Rav Tzvi Yehuda, for philosophy we have Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and we have other people. But the dominant figure for Halacha, and now the dominant figure at Yeshiva, is Rav Avraham. The problem with Rav Tao was that he challenged Rav Avraham, and every generation has to go to the leader of their generation. The leader of our generation is Rav Avraham, so we go to him, and if we have to alter things a tiny bit from Rav Tzvi Yehuda, fine, we do that. No, not for Har Hamor. And Rav Tao is not the Rosh Yeshiva, he's the Nasi, because he also wanted to have someone as Rosh Yeshiva who was a Talmudist. but he is the most central figure. In that, his role was similar to the Hasidic Rebbe, to Ratzi Yehuda Cook, or to the Altar of Sabotka. The Altar of Sabotka never gave shiur. The Altar of Sabotka spoke about Musar. But he was the most important and dominant figure at the yeshiva. But he was not a master in Shas and Poskim, in the sense that he could give a shiur at the yeshiva. So it's the same with Rav Tal. Now, both of these yeshivas are very successful. Har Hamor, Merkaz. Merkaz obviously much more successful. Yeah, but even Har Hamor, there's mechinas. You have these pre-army academies. You have other yeshivas that look to Har Hamor, and there are hundreds and hundreds of yeshiva students who look to Rav Tzvi Tal as their leader. And of course, there's hundreds and hundreds, thousands of yeshiva students, and there's great yeshivas who look to Rav Avram Shapiro as their spiritual leader. So the great separation in right-wing religious Zionism, in the Chardal movement, and I'll speak about it in a few minutes. I don't know if you could tell the difference between them. The Merkaz guy and the Har Hamor guy, they dress the same, they have the big yarmulke, so I don't know outwardly if there's a difference. Again, I think this would, thank you, David, this would fit in very nicely with Rav Tal seeing the state as really inherently valuable. Now, when Rav Avraham was chief rabbi, he couldn't be involved in politics. It's against the law. You can't be involved in any politics. So whether Rav Yonah Metzger crosses the line with his public declaration in support of Rav Avraham Sherman, I don't know. But the law is you can't be involved in politics. However, when he left the chief rabbinate, in the early 1990s, he becomes the leader of those opposed to withdrawal. From anywhere, Gaza, the West Bank, he saw this as a halachic issue, pure and simple. He issued a psak during the Gaza withdrawal, which then other people joined this psak, including Rabbi Binovich, and this psak would have enormous implications. The psak was that soldiers were obligated to refuse orders to be involved in an evacuation of a settlement, even if this meant going to jail. Now, obviously, this has enormous implications because you can't have a situation where the army is not following orders. And Rav Avraham Shapiro was, according to his critics, involved in sedition. And he said, you can come and put me in jail, and I'm happy to go. This had implications afterwards, although I don't think this has continued, but there was talk about shutting down the Hesder yeshivas that went along with it, because certain Hesder yeshivas, which operate with government approval, so how can you have a Hesder yeshiva telling its students to violate the government rule when the government orders, when the Hesder yeshivas are part of the government system? I know there was talk of even perhaps putting Rav Nachman Rabinovich on some sort of trial, and none of this came to anything. I don't think many listened, though, to Rav Avram's psak. There were some very brave ones who did, who served time, who refused to follow orders, but I think it's very difficult to ask an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old to do something like this, to have the courage, especially when you had people like Rav Aviner and others saying, don't do this. Rav Tal, don't violate orders. But there were some who violated orders, who refused to participate. Very few, as far as I can see, and it didn't stop anything. I remember reading a case of, well, maybe David Eisen can tell us more about this. I think the standard sentence was 30 days in the military brig. It wasn't as if they were sentenced to 5 years in jail or anything like that. They just refused to participate. They weren't, as far as I know, no one was given any sort of court-martial or anything like that. One officer, and you can understand, an officer. The chief rabbi of Israel, of the army of Tzahal, is himself a Merkaz person. There were people who wanted him to take a harsh stand, and I guess that would have meant him being fired and all. Nothing came of that. And there were officers. There were officers who were told, Rav Avram said, ordered them, as it were, not to participate because they were Merkaz people, or used to be Merkaz people, and they didn't listen. So he was not very successful in that. I mentioned last time, I'll mention again for those who weren't here, if you want to see how this all came out in an ugly way, go to the website aviner.net, where the followers of Ravavram Shapiro, who always had issues with Ravavinir for a variety of halachic reasons and other things. This was now their opportunity, and you can see on the website they took it upon themselves to destroy Rav Avinair. There's a talk, about a 25-minute talk by Rav David Bar Chaim dealing with the withdrawal from Gaza. You have other things there, all about the issues he's been involved in. You have the psukim of Rav Avraham or Mordechai Yahu and the leaders of the Chardalim declaring his psukim invalid. This was the last straw, that when Rav Avinair publicly opposed Rav Avram Shapiro. And I mentioned last class, Rav Avram Shapiro never mentioned Rav Avinair by name. But when he spoke about rabbis who are not able to paskin on the most difficult issues, and yet they take it upon themselves to paskin on this issue, these are the ones that we cannot respect. And this was repeated over and over again by his students. It was with regard to Rav Avinair. Now, Rav Lichtenstein came out very strongly against Rav Avram Shapiro's position. And in tradition, a couple of years ago, they published Rav Lichtenstein's essay. And Rav Avram was too old to reply, and he was, at this time, he was weak. And his grandson-in-law, who's involved in Merkaz, Silvetsky's his name, he penned the reply. But I don't think anyone wants to read Rav Lichtenstein debating some young guy. How old is he? 35 years old? 40? I don't know who this guy is. If you want to have a debate with two Gedolei Yisrael, you want to have Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Avram Shapiro. But I don't even think you really need Rav Avram Shapiro to debate. The issue for Rav Avram was clear, and he made it clear, and his students made it clear. Just like if the army tells you to eat this cheeseburger, or to violate Shabbos, and I'm not saying violate Shabbos for a military purpose. If the officer comes in and says, on Saturday, we're putting up this new building here, we're setting up these tents, and this could just as easily be done Sunday, you're not permitted to listen. If they come in, they decide they're going to start serving you trade, you can't listen. This is no different than that. Unlike what Rav Lichtenstein or Rav Avinair speak, they distinguish between personal mitzvot and national mitzvot, and all, Rav Avram did not see a difference. He thought that it was a simple violation of halacha to uproot people's homes. If you're in a situation where it's clear you're all going to be killed if you don't withdraw from the land, then you can withdraw. We don't have to be suicidal here. However, and I don't know if Rav Tal might say we have to stay there. But in a situation as in Gaza or in the West Bank, you're in violation of halacha, pure and simple, and there's nothing to debate. It's not a political issue for him. Yet with all the disappointment, he never stopped believing in the significance of the state of Israel. After the withdrawal, there were certain people who said we should not say halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut. We shouldn't say a bracha for the government. And Rav Avram Shapiro disagreed with this. Let me take back to the government. I shouldn't say about the government. I'm not sure what his position was about the government, but he was asked about the state of Israel, per se. Should you say Halal and Yom Ha'atzmaut? And he says, yes, you distinguish between the state and the government. I'm not sure about when I say his position on the government, because Rav Gorin, towards the end of his life, did not think you should make a Misha Berach for the state, for the government. For the state, yes, but not for the government. Rav Avram explained in lectures, some of these you can listen to, I believe, on yeshiva.org.il, that you distinguish between the government and the state. The state is significant. It's the center for Torah in the world, even if we're strongly opposed to the government. And unlike Rav Tal, Rav Avram never thought that you have to speak with respect for a government or a prime minister that is involved in such what he regarded as terrible violations of not just halakha, but his basic Jewish and ethical values. Rav Avram was a major force, maybe the major force, after Tzvi Yehuda died, in the development of the Chardal movement, and together with Mordechai Eliyahu became the leader, the posek for it. The Chardal movement is the post-67 development of right-wing religious Zionism, strict in halacha, believers in the settlement of the land of Israel, very different than the old-style Mizrahi that many of us grew up with. And Rav Avraham is front and center of making Torah study central to young Mizrahi boys. The old Mizrahi was very much centered on Balabatim. They never built great yeshivas. That wasn't part of their ethos. And they didn't want rabbis to be involved in politics. When Rav Kook came out with his famous proclamation that women could not vote in the 1920s, Rav Yehuda Leib Maimon said that, Rav Kook, your job is to decide halacha. On issues of national importance, that's our job. We're going to, you know, the Mizrahi, the leaders of the political party, we're going to determine and decide these matters. And when it comes to building up the state, the future state, we're going to teach the rabbis. The Chardal movement brought a form of Das Torah, this idea that the rabbis have authority in non-religious matters. I shouldn't say non-religious, non-halachic matters, that the Haredim are led by completely. The Chardal movement brought this notion of Das Torah into religious Zionism. Rav Goren tried to do it. He wanted to create a party in which he'd be the decider, the posting for this, the guide. It never took off. But the Jewish people was ready for it, at least in Israel. They were ready for it by the late 1980s, the early 90s. And Das Torah, through Rav Avram Shapiro and Mordechai Yahu, enters the Chardal. People take their cues from these Gedoli. And Rav Avram was the leader of this movement, together with Mordechai Yahu. But Rav Avram had a different view of Das Torah than the Haredim. He explains it in an essay included in this volume, Morashah, Rav Avram Shapiro's essays. And he asserts, it's quite fascinating, he asserts that sages do have a proper role in determining what we should do in national matters. The old Mizrahi approach was, we want nothing to do with the rabbis. The rabbis have nothing to say to us in these matters. If I want to know what the halacha is, if I want to know if something's muktzah on Shabbos, I go to the rabbis. But anything else, I decide myself. The Haredim, deciding everything, leaving everything in the hands of the rabbis. So the rabbis decide everything. The people are just supposed to follow what the rabbis say. They don't have any personal thoughts on voting. Or not just voting, all sorts of matters. Rav Avram Shapiro staked out a middle ground. Rav Lichtenstein famously also staked out a middle ground, but not as much in the middle as Rav Avram. Rav Lichtenstein is more to the left, if you want to use the word left, that the rabbis are still someone we should consult and take their advice, but obviously he doesn't believe in Das Torah. He also points out a paradox, an irony. Rav Lichtenstein points out that the modern Orthodox, they always complain that the rabbis don't know anything. They're not involved in the world. So here you have rabbis who want to be involved in the world and have a say about it, and yet then the modern Orthodox says, well, we don't want to hear what you have to say. I don't know. I think he's really, it's incorrect what Rav Lichtenstein's saying. It's not that the modern Orthodox, they want rabbis to be involved in the world if they think the rabbis know something. The problem is that they think, a lot of them don't think the rabbis know anything, so they'll listen to Rav Lichtenstein's opinion. But there's also autonomy. He discusses in the Orthodox Forum volume about autonomy. The modern Orthodox world is based, to a large extent, on freedom, personal freedom. So the idea that rabbis are going to tell you what to think about, who to vote for, it just doesn't go with that ideology. Rav Avraham asserts that sages have a role to play in determining national policy, but it's not a theocracy. The Gedolim don't have the final word. In case anyone has any illusions about this, the Haredi world in Israel. I don't think America, I don't think any American Haredi would want to live in such a world. But the Haredi world in Israel believes in a theocracy, just like in Iran. Rav Shach has essays writing about how democracy is a terrible thing. They believe that the rabbis should be in complete control. Now, we've never had a theocracy in Judaism, except for maybe when the high priests ruled for some generations. And that was a disaster, because whenever religion gets involved in government, it corrupts religion. But traditional Judaism is not a theocracy. It's whatever it is, a kingship or the Abravanel, or more of a democracy. The rabbis are involved, because you have to determine if you have the Sanhedrin, you need to know whether something is halachically permissible, but the rabbis never made decisions. But the Haredi ethos is that until the Messianic era, it is a theocracy, it should be a theocracy, and I think from their conception, the Messiah will just be another great gadol, so the theocracy will continue. Rav Avram disagrees, and he cited an amazing source to demonstrate this, and I cited this in one of my Sfarim blog posts, the one on rabbis and communism, but for those who didn't see it, I'll repeat it again. He cited a book from Rav Yehoshua Leib Graubart called Sefer Zikaron. If you recall last class, I told you that of the Gedolim, Rav Avram Shapiro had the greatest knowledge of Sfarim, of books. Not just halacha, that you could say Rav Avad Yosef, but of books of all certain sorts of matters. He was a real bibliophile. And there's this unusual, this rare book, Sefer Zikaron. You can't get it anymore in print. It has one printing, But it's found on HebrewBooks.org. You can read it. All full of all sorts of great stuff, as is all of Galbert's information in all of his books. But Rav Avram had this book. Rav Yehuda Leib Graubart ends up, when he leaves Europe, he goes to Toronto. And he writes a number of volumes of response, of Chavalim bin Naimim. He establishes the Erev in Toronto in the 30s, I think it was, one of the oldest Erev in North America. He's a Mizrahi Rav, a great Posek, Gadol Bisrael, certainly in Canada. But this book, Sefer Zikaron, was written right after the first Russian Revolution. And it's an important, indeed vital source for the history of Orthodoxy during the final days of Tsarist Russia and the post-revolution era. And people are not aware of this. Jewish historians, people who write about Orthodoxy, are not aware of this source. I hope now, since I called people's attention to it in the Sparim blog, that they are aware of it, because the information there is priceless. He records the debates among the great rabbis of the time, how to relate to the revolution, all sorts of things. And take a look at the book, those who want more interest, more points about it. I'll just mention a few of the things that I know some of you will find interesting. He describes what is it about Lithuania and about Poland that the rabbinate had such a decline in the 100 years he's talking about. And he blames it. He describes how the Hasidic world really destroyed the authority of the rabbinate because of the Hasidic Rebbe and their courts. Quite fascinating. Then he describes how he was trying to establish a modern Jewish day school with secular studies, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very much opposed to it. And he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he said to the Rebbe, he says, perhaps you don't know, Rebbe, that many of your Hasidim, Rov Anshei Hasidav, most Lubavitchers, he's talking about in Russia, Hayoshi Varim Agdolot, that live in the big cities, send their sons and daughters to the general schools. But they say for Ami, Umachalim Shabbos, and they are Machal Shabbos at these schools. And I can tell you, my family, my great grandfather was Chabad. And his children, that's exactly what Graubart's talking about. Nothing became of them, religiously. And the Rebbe answered him, how do you know that I don't know this? And Rav Graubart replied to him, if so, then my wonder is even more. Why are you opposed to Hebrew gymnasiums, which will be under the gymnasiums, schools with secular studies, which will be under the approval of the Orthodox? And the Rebbe was quiet and didn't say a word. The approach of the Rebbe is not surprising. It's Rav Dessler's approach also we spoke about. They were afraid to alter the traditional yeshiva, even if it meant losing the majority of the young people. That's the only way I can explain, though, the Rebbe's response. In another passage, Rav Graubart explains, why should all the doctors who are Jewish not be Orthodox? In no respect do we acknowledge that one who prays and puts on tefillin, he cannot be a good doctor. And then if you're careful in Shabbos and eating kosher, you can't be an engineer. Look at our past. Look at Rav Sadia going the Rambam, the Ramban, etc., etc. These give proof that Chil Shabbos and eating treif is not connected to philosophy and medicine. So you have a great affirmation here of the value of secular studies and the importance of it. He writes this because there was a whole movement right after the revolution to bring together the rabbis and to create modern schools. And I'll tell you in a few minutes who went along with it and why this is relevant then to the whole idea of Das Torah that Rav Shapiro is speaking about. In my Sparim blog post, I also quoted his recollections of the Rugashover, which are great. How the Rugashover, this poor man who's supported by the Lubavitchers and yet knows more than anyone in the world and is no respecter of Rabbanim. He refers to the greatest sages by their last names, and it's a great quote. But getting back to our point, after the February 17 revolution, Kerensky comes to power, and the Orthodox in Russia form a group called Masoret, Tradition, V'Chayrut, and Freedom. They're free for the first time. And this group contained both Mizrahi, you know, religious Zionists, and the non-Zionists, or the anti-Zionists. And they were supposed to send a group, a delegation, to the All-Russian Jewish Congress, which was supposed to take place, a whole gathering of all the Jews in Russia. Because of the Soviet Revolution, or perhaps we should say the Soviet coup d'etat, later in the year. This never took place. But this group envisioned itself becoming a political power with the establishment of the new government. And over 50 rabbis came to Moscow in 1917, right after the revolution, for discussions about how to create a new Jewish society in Russia. They had seen the problems in Poland with the irreligiosity. They saw what went on in Germany. You know, there was how they took secular studies and were able to create a modern Jew. In Lithuania, there was a whole Torah im Derech Eretz type of movement that in the interwar years got going. It was actually centered, believe it or not, in Telz. Telz had a gymnasium, and the rabbinic leader was Rav Avraham Dov Ber Kama Shapiro. The Divine Avraham was a leader of a modern type of orthodoxy. There are some people to this day who don't think well of the Divine Avraham. There's a rabbi in Washington Heights. His name is Rav Tuvia Lastun, and I have a letter from him. He's from Telz, and he writes, quote, that Rav Avraham Shapiro was a great man, but many of his ideas were not in line with the Orthodox. What does that mean, the Orthodox? He was one of the great postmen of the 20th century, the Divine Avraham. If you read the books on the Holocaust and Halacha, he figures a great deal because he gave important psakim. But his most famous psak is when the Judenrat, should they cooperate with the Nazis to in handing out cards to allow certain people to live, others would have to be taken. But what Lazdun meant was he didn't agree with the go along with the maybe the yeshiva world's vision. Among the rabbis in attendance were Rav Avraham Shapiro, Rav of Kovno, Rav Avraham Burstein, we spoke about him, Rav Itzel Rabinovich, Rav Itzel Ponevezer, and Rav Aaron Walken of Pinsk. Now, what was one of the issues they had to discuss? Well, the masses had no property. All the property in Russia was owned by the big, the princes, the czar, the magnates. One of the new issues that this group was going to have to take a stand on was agrarian redistribution, because that was going to be front and center to the new government. With the Tsar overthrown, it was possible not just to take his land, but the land belonging to all these rich people and redistribute it. And that's what the average people wanted. However, is this in accord with Jewish law? Rabbi Rakefet likes to say, he's been to Russia a few times, that when you go to the Hermitage there, it's a halachic question, can you go? Because, is that what's called, the Hermitage? Is that the name of the museum, I think, in St. Petersburg? Because you're looking at, or is that in, I get confused between that museum and the one in East Berlin. But all the stuff there, yes, all the stuff there is confiscated. So you're getting benefit from robbery. Well, is it according to Jewish law redistribution? Can you confiscate another's property? The government was going to take property away from people and distribute it. Is that in accord with Jewish law? I'm sure most of us have seen the movie, I forget the name of it, Omar Sharif, one of the great movies of the 20th century. My in-laws named my sister-in-law Lara, because my mother-in-law loved that movie so much, Lara's theme. Yes, Dr. Zhivago. Can you take people's property? Rev Graubart, in his Sefer, records the dispute. He records, he has all, it's almost like minutes of the various speakers. And most of the Rabbanim oppose this. In fact, maybe all the Rabbanim oppose this, because how can you take people's property? And then, if I'm a Jew and I'm a rich Jew, how can you support a policy, I made my money fairly, where the government's going to come in and take my property and distribute it to others? Rav Itzel Ponevezer stands up and, as recorded by Rav Graubart, says as follows, quote, "It's necessary to get involved in the political side of things, and through it we will bring the young and the street to our group. We see that the Jewish people want this." I'll get back to your point in a minute, Simcha. The Jewish people were poor, the masses, they wanted redistribution. And it is certainly from God. And the people of Israel are higher and more exalted than the Gedolim. Israel, if they are not prophets, are sons of prophets. In other words, if the Jewish people think that the concentration of land in the hands of a small minority is unjust and should be redistributed, even if the rabbis claim that redistribution is against Jewish law and is robbery, it doesn't matter. The opinion of the Jewish people overrides that of the rabbis. This is in direct opposition to the Haredi notion that the views of Balabatim are in opposition to Das Torah. According to the Haredim, if you want to know, Rav Shach said this many times, if you want to know what Das Torah is, look at the view of the Balabatim, and then the exact opposite is the view of Das Torah. This goes back to a joke made by one of the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, I think it's the Prisha on the Torah, that Das Balabatim is Hefech Das Torah. I always laugh about this, because if that's the case, then you have people like Jonathan Rosenblum, who claim to be able to explain why the Haredi Rabbani adopt certain positions, which from our standpoint seem quite strange and don't make any sense. Well, that's understandable, because we're Balabatim, and they shouldn't make any sense to us. But they can't make any sense to Rosenblum either. So he should just be honest and say he doesn't understand them either, and it doesn't make any sense. But he accepts the Gedolim. Instead, he tries to explain them, and it doesn't make any sense after he explains them. But the whole point is that you're not supposed to be able to understand them. But Rav Avram Shapiro says differently. This is what we're going to pick up next class. There is a Das Torah, but the Das Torah is in the hands of the people. The rabbis have a say, but the people can override the rabbis. The rabbis don't have the final authority. I need a few minutes to really develop this idea, what he's getting at here. Then I'll get to Simcha's point, because this doesn't mean that halacha goes out the door. You still need some sort of halacha. And there's still a number of things we need to discuss about Rav Avram Das Torah, his machokas with Rav Moshe Feinstein, about the Ethiopian Jews. A few more things. Unfortunately, we'll have to wait till we get back the next semester. I'll say, because we'll forget about this for next semester, but Ravitzla himself was a bit of a communist. He read Marx, and one of his sons was arrested, served time in a Tsarist prison for being a communist. We have a testimony from early on that he said that he thought that Marx had great ideas, but he can't agree with his positions. This is Yaakov Mark quoting Ravitzla, because they oppose the Torah law that protects private property. That apparently must have been an earlier view, because by 1917, by the time of the revolution, he no longer felt that private property was sacrosanct. And we will explain from a halachic standpoint, even when we return, why he could feel this. But one of his sons, as I said, was arrested, and Ravitzla was greatly respected by the radicals. Most of the radicals, the communists, hated the rabbis. After all, the rabbis were the clerics, and the communism is anti-clericalism at its height. The rabbis were aligned with the rich people. It was the rabbis have always been aligned with the powerful ones, but Ravitzla was different. They loved Ravitzla, because Ravitzla had a real appreciation for, and really a sympathy for, socialism. He was a socialist, and for the workers. Not to mention the fact that his son, I think even more than one son, was a communist, but one son was actually arrested for communist activities. So we'll have to stop here. We will pick up next semester, finish Rav Avram Shapiro, and then I said we're going to go into Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, great Rav of Italy, Sephardic Rav, Rav Yaakov Dobrolovsky, the Ridbaz. I haven't spoken. I was asked, a couple of you wanted me to speak more about the Brisker Derech and the Machokas over it, which we mentioned. I'm holding off on this. I'll deal with it when I deal with the Ridbaz. The greatest opponent in modern times of the Brisker approach of learning is Rav Yaakov Dobrolovsky, the Ridbaz of Slutsk, and then of Chicago, and then of Sfat. We will then move on to Yosef Eliel Henkin, who, before Rav Moshe Feinstein arrives on the scene, is the great posek of New York. Also, he has a lot to say, not just on halacha, in his essays. He, too, as we'll see, was a bit of a lefty, a bit of a liberal. I mean, he thought it was appropriate to write a defense of rent control in his Torah writings. You'll see what I have to say about that when we talk about it. On the Sforim blog, I said that rabbis, they should stick to the Torah and not get involved in economics. But we'll talk about it, because it's not important whether he's right or wrong about rent control, but what leads a rub to have a conception like that. And we will conclude, if we get to it next semester, if not the one after that, with Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. This is in response to at least two requests of people who wanted me to do Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. So we will certainly do him in the future. Before I say goodbye to everyone for the summer, let me say that it was another great semester. Thank you for your comments, your corrections, your questions that forced me to do more research. It was a great group, as always. Does anyone have any final questions or comments on anything we did today or anything of the Gedolim we did this semester? Thank you. I'm sure there'll be articles in the Jerusalem Post and others. I know Simcha said he emailed me, but I haven't checked it yet, dealing with this. I'm supposed to write a review of Tzvi Zohar's new book on conversion that Michael Broyd already reviewed. They wanted me to write the review for the Ma'orot, the Yeshiva Torah Journal. Tzvi Zohar wanted me, the assumption being that I'm going to give it a good review. I don't know that. I haven't read it. I looked at the Hebrew, but I haven't looked at the English. So I have no idea what I'm going to say. And it could be that the part of the problem is that he wants to create a whole new idea, Tzvi Zohar, of what conversion is. But in any event, I'm looking forward to going into more detail with this, because the conversion business is not going to end. Yes, the heir apparent to Rav Yoshev is Rav Chaim Konevsky, the son of the Stipler. Rav Chaim Konevsky himself is deserving of a class. His sfarim are the strangest, the weirdest sfarim imaginable. He has one-word answers to a page, page-and-a-half questions, and now in the last year there's been about five books with just his one- or two-word answers. He also has some strange ideas. One of the people posted on the blogs, he believes that the Jews have less teeth than non-Jews. He has crazy, crazy stuff. He's also a genius. Probably the greatest genius in the Haredi world. He's old, yes, but he's not as old as Rav Yoshev, so in the Haredi world, you only become the Gadol Shvedolim, the Pope, in your 80s and up. Rav Shach only became in his 80s also, so if he, how old is he? He's in his 70s? I think, is the heir apparent, and he's the son-in-law of Rav Yoshev. So that makes him Chatna de Benesia. I believe in the Haredi world, he is the most respected after Rav Yoshev. That is my sense in the Haredi world. I don't think there's anyone who... I mean, you have other figures. You have Rav Steinman. See, Rav Steinman is not an expert in halacha. He's not known to be an expert in Shas the way Rav Konevsky is. So I don't think there's anyone else in Rav Konevsky's league. You can know when you look at these posters, the cherims, you look at how the names are put, who's put on top. You're looking at Tein Ne'eman. When Yatei Ne'eman begins referring to Rav Chaim Konevsky as Maran, they might already do it, then you know that he's the heir apparent, because he'll be crowned. Look, Rav Yoshev should live for 120, but after he passes away, the Yatei Ne'eman will crown someone. Rav Zilberstein is another son-in-law, but he's not the level of Konevsky in the Haredi world. As far as I can read, he's not. He doesn't measure up to him in terms of the respect of the power brokers of the Haredi world. I read that Netanyahu is going to go visit Rav Chaim Konevsky this week. He's also political. Rav Zilberstein is not political. Rav Chaim Konevsky is making all sorts of political statements. And if you're asking me about Raka, I think it will be Rav Chaim Konevsky. We mentioned that Rav Avram Shapiro raised the question, why is it that most of the great poskim are mekilim, are lenient? Because they were chosen. The people didn't go to the machmirim. The people choose who become gedolim. 100%. You have people who were, in terms of sheer knowledge, were as great as Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein, but their personalities didn't lead them to be accepted, or also just mazel. Had Rav Moshe Feinstein taken that job in Seattle, let's say, he wouldn't be Rav Moshe. So there's a lot that goes into it. But if you look in the Haredi world now in Israel, they seem to have gathered around Rav Chaim Konevsky as the authority. That's how you become a gadol in that world. It's you're accepted, and if you're quiet, if you never make your feelings known, you won't be accepted. That's no different than in the modern world also. You have to accept people. If you don't accept them, they have to have... Look, there's many Rosh Yeshiva at YU. Why is it that only Rav Schechter became known as a gadol, as an outstanding sage? There's a reason for it, because the people sense that there's something special, both about his personality and about his learning. So that's the same thing. No one ever said that the gadolim were the smartest or knew the most. Not at all. Yeah. I mean, like I said, his answers could be one sentence. Not one sentence, one word. One or two word answers, and anyone can go visit him. His views are the typical B'nai B'rak position, not the Jerusalem position. But I don't think there's anyone in the world today who has his knowledge. He hasn't written tshuvos, though. He hasn't written halachic writings. He's written commentaries on certain tractates. But look, Rav Eliashiv never really wrote responsa either, the way you think of a typical posek. And he became the posek ador. So that's the answer to your question, Barak, in my humble opinion. This happened, Rav Shapiro was already quite elderly, number one. And number two, I don't think Rav Shapiro thought he had to respond. Rav Achnasi's opinion has been known for a long time. Rav Avram gave his opinion. What does he need to respond for? He made it very clear, and his Talmidim made it very clear, that this is not a national issue. This is an individual issue. Each soldier called upon to evacuate a settlement is participating in an Avera. And therefore, there's no need to debate. I also think that Rav Avram probably saw himself as a higher level than Rav Lichtenstein, that it would not be his kavod, for the kavod of his Talmidim, to debate with Rav Lichtenstein. You know, this isn't a matter that he needs to start debating, because if he debates Rav Lichtenstein, he debates other Rabbanim, there's no need to debate. Rav Avram Shapiro was very cognizant of his position. And I'm not going to say this is an ego thing. I think he saw himself as representing Torah at a certain level, and that Rav Lichtenstein is from the previous generation. You know, Rav Avram Shapiro is from the older generation, and that Rav Avram Shapiro was careful never to get involved in debates with younger rabbis. I think he just thought it wasn't kavod to Torah. I don't know. But that's the answer. The answer is that he was already elderly. Rav Yaakov Weinberg says this. Rav Yaakov Weinberg said that he couldn't go to the Skokie Yeshiva because Rav Kreisworth would be the Rosh Yeshiva, and it's not kavod Torah for him to answer to someone who's a generation younger than him. Now, is that ego? Rabbi Weinberg says this is the kavod Torah, it's the kavod of his students, that their Rebbe can't be turned into a second-rate person now. I don't know. You could put it either way. I mean, is Rav Soloveitchik, would he have started responding to someone, even a great Talmud Chacham from a younger generation? It's many Rosh Yeshiva or Poskim are cognizant that they don't want to get into a debate with people from a younger generation because it somehow is a diminution of the Kavod Torah, not for themselves personally, but for the office they hold. I don't know. These are all speculation. But he was elderly at the time. And as I said, I don't think there was a real debate issue as far as he was concerned to debate. Rav Lichtenstein goes into such detail. For Rav Avram, it was quite simple. There's halacha. You can't violate it. I hope all of you enjoyed and learned things. I try to be the Energizer Bunny. Thank you very much. And again, look forward to speaking to you all offline. Have a wonderful summer.